From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If you watched cable news on Thursday, you saw more than stories about terrorist bombs in Turkey and Iraq, President Bush in England, protests in Miami, and Wacko Jacko on the lam. You saw the battle for the soul of TV journalism.
Coming up, twin attacks on British targets in Turkey. Coming during President Bush's state visit to London, the death toll is rising.
D-Day here in London. We'll see how that big demonstration looks when it winds up here on Trafalgar Square.
And this Fox News alert, protesters are clashing with police in Miami just outside International Trade Talk.
The King of Pop is expected to surrender here in Santa Barbara.
The battle raged all day as square-jawed anchors moved briskly between stories, approaching each with an equal amount of gravity and urgency. There was deja vu in Trafalgar Square.
They're bringing down in effigy a statue of George W. Bush.
And scenes of devastation in Istanbul.
The synagogues were bombed on Saturday. They had a couple of...
But mostly we saw the media straining at the reins in pursuit of the prize pheasant, the 40-pound mackerel, the once and forever biggest kahuna.
Underway. We don't know when or where we might see Michael Jackson
but
today.
Thousands of reporters are waiting for...
Cable's Keystone cops were on the trail.
Outside. We're keeping an eye on this airport because we are receiving word that Michael Jackson has indeed left Las Vegas.
Let me interrupt real quickly. I am seeing a Learjet land.
Just
I just want to point that out.
Access it indicated Hollywood that this indeed is not the plane. It has a
what to do, what to do. Even ABC's unimpeachable Nightline this week bumped more serious fare to cover the predations of the alleged pederast of pop. Give the public what they need, or what we think they need, or give the public what they want, or what they seem to want.
And top of everything we're doing, I feel like we're kind of beating a dead horse a little bit, but let's press on anyway.
Yes, there was a battle on television for television as the big stories vied for airtime. And as we watched Thursday, images of death in Turkey and angry crowds in London receded while the cable shows returned more and more often to the other story until it saturated the airwaves.
I have nothing else to say.
Jermaine, please stay with me. Jermaine, please stay with me. Jermaine, are you still with me? Okay.
The victor was inevitable. Simply irresistible. Michael Jackson won hands down. Or more accurately, with his hands up.
The King of Perp faces the music in handcuffs. Superstar Michael.
As we heard, President Bush was on his state visit to London when truck bombs exploded near British targets in Istanbul. On Friday, we spoke to reporter Michael Goldfarb from London about the reaction of the British press to the American president.
You know, here, people, you know, think of him as his cartoonists depict him as, you know, a kind of cowboy who doesn't really know what goes on in the world and is kind of led around by his advisors. And he delivered a keynote address on Wednesday that was, first of all, the speech was incredibly well written by his speechwriting team. He delivered it at State of the Union level. I mean, he had to hit this one out of the park. And he won some converts, at least presentationally. Jon Snow, who is the host of the 7 p.m. news on Channel 4, and most journalists would acknowledge is the real media opinion setter in broadcasting in this country, wrote a very interesting intro to his evening news broadcast.
Good evening. Perhaps his lampoonists have had the better of him, but today George Bush has proved more assured and a better speaker than many had cracked him down to be. The content was the same. In amongst the state flummery today, he managed to weave a message of Methodist zeal, conjuring Tyndale, Wesley, and Locke. Tonight, Bush preaches an American-led cure for all the world's ills.
Plus, so was then Mr. Snow typical of the reaction after the president gave the keynote address?
Yeah, his response was actually echoed later that evening by Gavin Esler, who is the host of Newsnight, which is the BBC's equivalent program to Nightline.
Good evening. Whoever wrote George Bush's big speech in London today knew exactly which buttons to push for a British audience. Common sacrifice, shared values, strong praise for British valor and the Grand Alliance of the Second World War, plus at least two good jokes.
But then Thursday happened. Clearly, Britain was targeted by terrorists in Istanbul and suffered a lot of casualties. Did the tenor of the coverage change?
I mean, this trip is very neatly divided before Istanbul, after Istanbul, because British interests were targeted, because Tony Blair and Foreign Secretary Jack Straw actually had to attend to the business of government. They had to pay attention to what was happening. They were taking in reports that included news of the death of Britain's consul general in Istanbul. So in the middle of all of this was what we in the press were looking forward to most, which was the joint press conference between Tony Blair and George Bush. And we had anticipated that this might be the moment when the protective bubble that surrounds the president, his media handlers, we know keep him on a disciplined program in terms of how often he speaks to reporters, completely different from Tony Blair. But after you hear of events like what happened in Istanbul, when 27 people lose their lives, it would be churlish of the press to take the kind of approach that it often does. And so it ended up being a slightly different kind of press conference.
But there was at least some churlishness. In the left-leaning Guardian newspaper, columnist Polly Toynbee tied the bombing and the Bush visit together. She wrote, "Bombs in Istanbul are the only outcome from this presidential visit. George Bush brought no gifts to thank his ally for taking so much damage to support this politically alien president." And she goes on to cite the lack of concessions on tariffs and the lack of attention to the Israel-Palestine conflict and the lack of assurance that the U.S. won't cut and run from Iraq. And she concludes, "This visit has been all downside for our prime minister." So, was she a lone voice?
It is very much a part of the left-leaning press. You have to remember, 40% of the press is owned by Rupert Murdoch. It's conservative. You have the part of the press that was owned by Conrad Black until this week, the Daily Telegraph, which is the largest circulation broadsheet newspaper, very conservative. You have other less well-known in America tabloids like the Daily Mail, extraordinarily conservative. They were saying today, how can protesters go out in the streets when something like this has happened, and have they no shame saying George Bush is the greatest terrorist on the face of the earth when 27 people were murdered in Istanbul by Al-Qaeda? So that is actually the more general view and the more general opinion that people read.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Goldfarb is a senior correspondent based in London for WBUR Public Radio in Boston.
Throughout the late 80s and 90s, media mogul Conrad Black bought up more newspapers than anyone in history. In 3 years alone, he acquired more than 300 titles, including the Chicago Sun-Times, the UK's Daily Telegraph, and the Jerusalem Post. Black acquired struggling papers that were traditionally conservative, and those that were not, he reinvented to reflect his political bias. He also became a British citizen, joined the House of Lords, and became a fixture of British high society. Now the world's third largest media mogul has been dethroned. Lord Conrad was charged this week with misallocating funds and was forced to step down as CEO of the company he created, Hollinger Inc. Richard Siklus is a financial reporter for the Sunday Telegraph, and in 1997, he wrote a biography of Black. He's currently reporting from Vietnam, and he joined us to talk about Black from Hanoi. Briefly explain the circumstances behind this current scandal.
It's a combination of the pressure on Black's company from unhappy American shareholders who were concerned about the sums that he and his executives have been paid over the last few years, while the company, from a stock point of view, has not performed particularly well. You know, he's always contended that he did nothing wrong. He did appoint a special committee of his board to look into these allegations for the investors who were unhappy. And then as a result of that investigation, they said that they had unearthed $32.5 million in what they called unauthorized payments, and that's the shoe that dropped.
Now, weirdly, Lord Conrad is staying on with Hollinger, at least for the time being, as a non-executive chairman. Now, that strikes me as odd for somebody who has allegedly at least raided the cookie jar. How did he ever cut that deal?
He's maintaining his complete innocence and that this was all some kind of misunderstanding. So for now, I guess the board of Hollinger and the special committee that, you know, created this scandal by unearthing it is giving him the benefit of the doubt. Clearly, the board is not under his control anymore, and now he's in a non-executive position.
Lord Conrad didn't go into this exactly as a sympathetic figure. He made a reputation as a ruthless cost cutter. slashing jobs at his new acquisitions, or as he put it, drowning the kittens. And he isn't a big fan of journalism as it's currently practiced, is he?
Well, he's always been a critic of journalists who take a different ideological view from him or what he considers sloppy journalism. He had a track record of libel suits against various journalists, although he hasn't really done that in recent years so much. So I wouldn't say that as a blanket statement that he dislikes journalists, but he likes the ones he likes and doesn't like the others.
Now, Black is famously a political conservative. Do all his papers cleave to the same conservative viewpoint?
He definitely turned the Jerusalem Post, which he bought in the early 90s, from the left to the right, to put it simply. In Canada, when he owned the National Post, which is now owned by CanWest, it was definitely conceived as setting the right-wing agenda for the country. In the UK, the Telegraph has been traditionally the paper of the Tory party, and he's been viewed as a hardening right-wing editorial view, and he's been unabashedly pro-American.
Well, 15 or 20 years ago, Conrad Black was a sort of mirror image of Rupert Murdoch. They were both wildly acquisitive, picking up properties left and right, but they've clearly taken very different directions. Murdoch has continued to expand his media empire, and Lord Conrad Black has cut back on everything but, I guess, what he would regard as his crown jewels, especially the Sun-Times and the Daily Telegraph. Why do you think he took a different direction? Is it that he just desired to own the Telegraph and everything else was secondary, or could he not compete at that level?
I would say a combination of both. And, you know, he himself admitted to me back when I wrote my book that he did not see himself as the risk-taking equivalent of a Murdoch. I think he was looking for a comfortable level of moguldom where he could do other things. I mean, a guy like Murdoch, from my understanding, is 18 hours a day and constantly in touch with every branch of his empire, whereas Black, the last few years, from what I've heard, you know, he's written this book on FDR, he's been in the House of Lords, and, you know, apparently just isn't like that big a presence in his office anymore.
A comfortable level of moguldom. Do you think Murdoch could jump in to pick up the pieces of what is left of the Hollinger Empire?
I think you would have to look at the Telegraph, because the Telegraph and the Times are the Coke and Pepsi of quality national broadsheet papers in the UK. A lot of people think, even for somebody of Rupert's remarkable political connections, that he would have an impossible time trying to combine both papers. But I guess you could never count Murdoch out.
All right, Richard. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
Richard Sicklis is a financial columnist for the Sunday Telegraph in London.
Next up, how a national tragedy changed TV news and why Vicente Fox pulled the plug on Mexican cinema.
Don't forget, if you miss any part of the show, you can get free MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In broadcasting's younger days, going live was extremely difficult, costly, and rare. But exactly 40 years ago, a monumental tragedy occurred that made live coverage essential, no matter the cost, whenever a president left the White House. On the Media's Sarah Fischko prepared this recollection of a few dreadful days in November.
Ladies and gentlemen,
conductor Eric Leinsdorf, Symphony Hall, Boston, November 22, 1963.
We had a press report over the wires that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination.
If you were alive and over, say, 5 years old in November 1963, wherever you were, you remember it.
We will play the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony.
The nation heard the news over wire services, radio, by word of mouth, public announcement, and most dramatically, on television. Television took over our lives for what are sometimes called those four dark days in Dallas, the Friday of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday that followed.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
Radio was there, and wire services, and newspapers, but it took television exactly 10 minutes after shots were fired to go on the air that day.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
That began 4 days of on-air improvisation, television's first continuous coverage of a prolonged, painful breaking news story.
It was impossible to tell at once where Kennedy was hit, but bullet wounds in Governor Connally's chest.
There hadn't been an assassination of a president since McKinley at the turn of the century.
Thomas Daugherty is professor of film studies at Brandeis University and has written about the TV coverage of the Kennedy assassination.
So even without television, this would have been uniquely disorienting and shocking. With television, though, it becomes this indelible memory for an entire generation that with TV we can actually experience the news and watch it as it's unfolding in the same existential moment that the news is happening.
The information that we've had, which is no time, obviously, for speculation.
Remarkably, it had been earlier that very fall, September 1963, that CBS had expanded its nightly newscast to a half hour from its previous program of only 15 minutes a night. NBC followed soon after.
Newscasts expanded because they had to.
Reuven Frank was producer of the Huntley-Brinkley Report in the 50s and 60s and went on to be president of NBC News.
You know, we had been agitating for a half hour for a long time. With Kennedy, the television president, they thought maybe it had a shot. And it did.
And then that day in Dallas came, in quite a different technological era.
A telephone call from NBC's Robert McNeil, who was with the president's party.
There was a little waiting room with swing doors, and I looked inside, and there were two payphones that were empty.
Former anchor, now author, Robert McNeil was in Dallas covering the Kennedy motorcade for NBC.
And I grabbed one of them, and I kept it for the rest of the afternoon.
Bob, are you there? This is Frank McGee. Bob,
when I phoned from that payphone in Dallas, they couldn't connect me through to air. And I would say a sentence, and McGee would repeat it.
The president is seriously wounded.
Which was fine for me, because it slowed me down.
The shots which wounded the president occurred as the motorcade.
In 63,
was running through a huge crowd in downtown.
We were still to the point where a camera weighed, I don't know, 100 and something pounds, and a mobile unit was the size of a Santini Brothers truck.
Reuven Frank.
Our remote truck in Dallas broke down, not the television part of it, but the truck part of it, the engine. So NBC for much of that weekend was represented by a remote truck, this big, enormous thing, being towed around by a tow truck.
Obstacles, to be sure.
Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
But by the time the awful truth was known, the networks had resolved to broadcast continuously and remove commercials for the duration.
It was an instinctive reaction, I think. It was spontaneous and instinctive, and for the first time.
We knew that you couldn't have commercials. Some people on the money side started to agitate for going back to commercials, and we just threw them out of the office.
By the end of that first day, America was exhausted and transfixed.
6 o'clock, November 22nd.
Thomas Daugherty.
The cameras are there to record the coffin being taken off the plane and loaded into a hearse, and you see this image of Jackie Kennedy. Her dress and the stockings she's wearing are stained with blood, and she's, of course, looking utterly shattered. And it seems almost this, a voyeuristic intrusion into this very private moment.
The sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear.
By Saturday, a parade of dignitaries was filing by the body lying in state. There were more details about a suspect, Lee Harvey Oswald, and reporters were struggling with the reality of a new president.
Vice President Johnson, I'm sure that many of us have made a mistake and will repeat it.
Nothing could have prepared TV or its viewers for Sunday.
a lot of folks would say that it is the Sunday event that is truly the one that unhinges America ever after, and that it, you know, this is really when the 60s began.
It was Sunday morning.
Reuben Frank.
And the president of NBC was watching at home, along with half the country, and he was getting bored with what we were covering, and he said, switch to something live, he said. And the only thing we had live was Tom Pettit. Nobody really thought it was worth covering.
NBC reporter Pettit was following the prisoner, Oswald, as he was moved from jail to jail.
They switched, and there it was.
There is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. He's been shot.
CBS had had its cameras running, but they had switched to an essay at the time.
They insisted finishing the essay rather than coming to us live.
Dan Rather was in Dallas covering the Texas trip for CBS.
At a time when I was first asking, then calling, then screaming, come to us live. But decisions get made. At the time, to say I was disappointed would be a vast understatement.
Firecracker rang out. He grabbed his side and he said, ow!
Nielsen ratings have never even approached ever again. You know, the kind of, you know, stratosphere that they had on that day. Literally 93% of the American public was via television, you know, watching on Sunday.
Monday, the funeral.
You didn't need to have people nattering on about nothing and just bloviating to hold the airspace. There was enough inherent drama in millions of people weeping over their television sets.
What did television learn from November 1963?
From then on, the presidency, it just took over the news. By the way, I don't think this is peculiar to television. I think all news media. The White House bureaus, their coverage expanded exponentially. A lot of people felt they had missed the biggest story of their lives. And from then on, nothing the president did or does is not covered.
Dan Rather.
I think I know before Dallas, I had no idea of the power of television to move people. It's a shared national experience.
I didn't feel my own feelings until the day of the funeral.
Robert McNeil.
We were filming, and a man came and sat down and put a transistor radio down, and it happened to be tuned to the funeral in Washington at the moment when the Black Watch bagpipe band passed. And suddenly, all my defenses and everything just dissolved, and there I was sobbing, tears running down my face. There it was. And suddenly it just all poured out.
Television and all of us grew up those 4 days among those images. It was a crisis more fully appreciated by watching than by learning about. That's what television could and can do. Jackie Kennedy knew it, even that night in her bloody skirt. She'd been asked by many why she'd chosen not to change clothes. No, she said, let them see what they've done. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fishko.
When the Mexican film Amores Perros was nominated for the Best Foreign Film Oscar 2 years ago, it was the first time a Mexican movie had received the honor in more than a quarter century. That moment confirmed the resurgence of Mexican cinema after many years of meager output. So it came as a shocker this month when Mexican President Vicente Fox unveiled a budget proposal that would eliminate funds for the National Film School, the country's largest film studio, and IMCINE, the main film funding agency. The announcement has been met with howls of outrage, and not just from Mexico's film community. This week, the mayor of Mexico City said the city would take over the film school and find work for displaced employees if the cuts are made. These critics say the president's plan would spell the demise of Mexican cinema as we know it. Hyperbole? Not necessarily, says Ken Benzinger, who's been covering the hullabaloo for Daily Variety.
I don't think it's too far-reaching to say that this will have a very dramatic impact on Mexican cinema. It's really the backbone of Mexican production, starting with the film school where something like 50% of Mexican directors are coming out of, to the studio where a lot of it's being done, and finally this funding organization, which not only funds but also promotes film abroad and throughout the country. It really would sort of eviscerate the cinema here, and you would go from perhaps 30 productions a year to maybe 5.
In other industries, privatization has, in fact, built markets, not subtracted from them. Is it possible that someone with some money could buy the studio from the government and could fill the gap with private capital to produce, you know, even more than the 30 films a year that are being made in Mexico right now?
It's definitely possible, but I think that it's much more likely that someone who wants to make a shopping mall purchases that land because it just is worth more in the short run that way. I think it's hard to convince people that Mexican film is a viable commercial product at this point. I was talking to someone at IMCINE who told me that there's not a single bank that offers financing and investment in Mexican film. That's quite the contrary in the U.S., where there's lots of banks crawling all over each other to get a piece of the action when it comes to a big blockbuster. Very few films produced here make any money in the long run.
But there must be a gathering horror in Mexico at the notion that the juggernaut that is Hollywood will entirely take over its industry by filling the Mexican multiplexes with American exports.
Well, it's sort of sad to say, but the truth of the matter is most multiplexes are already full of American exports here. It's been a tooth and nail struggle as it is. And their feeling, that is the feeling of Mexican filmmakers, producers, directors, actors, pretty much everyone in the industry here, is that exactly what you said, that if these organizations disappear, it's just simply an impossible thing to fight against it.
On the other hand, what Mexican filmmakers and culture vultures may wish for can be entirely different from what the actual Mexican moviegoer wants to see. I can't help but think of a moment I had a few years ago. I was driving down a commercial highway in Monterrey, Mexico, with a Mexican host who was displaying with pride all of the American fast food restaurants that lined the boulevard, Fuddruckers and McDonald's and Chili's, of all things. And he was just delighted. He said, and before, it was just mountains. And they were lining up around the block to go into the Chili's. I guess people are lining up around the block to see Hollywood products. What kind of domestic reception did Y Tu Mama Tambien and Amores Perros have there?
The top-rated Mexican film in history in terms of box office was last year's Crimen de Padre Amaro, Crime of Father Amaro. But it doesn't come close to what Spider-Man did in Mexico. It doesn't come close to what The Matrix is going to do in Mexico. In fact, I think The Matrix in about 2 weeks will surpass what Father Amaro did in its 10-week run in Mexico. This is a country that is extremely consumptive of American culture and has a very mixed feelings about what it's consuming. And the truth of the matter is that Mexican film, and to some extent rightly so, has a more art house image to it. And this is a country of 100 million people, and what appears to be the fact is that most of the people don't want to see the creative art house film. They do want to see what comes out of Hollywood. And I think, again, like you said, that's a pretty good additional disincentive for success in Mexican film.
Well, Ken, thank you very much.
Not at all.
Ken Bensinger writes for Daily Variety. He spoke to us from Mexico City.
And this week, a new frontier was crossed for funding films in the U.S. For the first time, ordinary movie lovers can stake their claim in an independent film by buying shares in a new IPO known as Billy Dead, Inc. Based on the novel by Lisa Reardon, Billy Dead is a film, or will be a film, once Keith Gordon directs it, once Ethan Hawke produces and stars in it, and especially once Civilian Capital raises the money by selling 900,000 shares at about $8.75 apiece. Instead of trying to negotiate the Byzantine byways of the usual Hollywood money trail, Billy Dead, Inc. is taking it straight to the fans through an online brokerage firm called Civilian Capital. It's a new stab at a solution to the big problem of raising big money for not-so-big movies. Director Keith Gordon talked about why he was attracted to the scheme in a press conference this week.
You know, it's an incredibly arduous process. It usually is a huge mess of sticking together 10% from company A, 10% from company B. By the time you come to company J, company A is no longer in business anymore. So here's a chance to put film financing together in a more direct, clean, efficient, great way, where maybe you can actually make a film sometime close to the time the initial impulse came to all get together and do that film. So to me, that's a really exciting thing, too.
Barry Polterman, the founder and president of Civilian Capital, says the investment in Billy Dead, Inc. is not for everyone.
I want to point out it's a high-risk sort of speculative investment. It's more along the lines of biotech or some early-stage company that hasn't really created its product yet, so you don't know how it's going to do. But if these are people that you really believe in, the filmmakers and the people that are making the project, then it's an interesting way to put a small amount of money at risk in a pretty exciting investment.
You're offering a share for less than the price of a movie ticket, at least in New York.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true. The shares are less than the price of a movie ticket, but there's a minimum order of 100 shares, so you have to buy $875 worth of shares to start.
And do you think, obviously, if this thing gets off the ground, that it'll be a big boost for independent film?
You know, I think so. I think there's an awful lot of amazing product out there that has an awful lot of trouble getting made, and not just sort of the small Sundance-type films, but, you know, Lord of the Rings spent years trying to get its financing together. Spider-Man spent years trying to get its financing together. And we think this is a more direct way to bring those kind of projects to their fans and allow their fans to greenlight them.
Investors won't have a stake in the distribution deal and in the decision to dissolve the company. So why are they shut out of those specific decisions?
Distribution is a very complex decision that we believe should be left in the hands of the experts. As far as the dissolution of the company, the initial strategy of the company is to exist to make a single film and then dissolve and return the equity to the shareholders. The company is specifically not chartered to do anything else, like to, you know, go off and make widgets or start making other films.
Why did you pick Billy Dead to begin this landmark proposition? Why is this the right picture for this financing scheme?
It is a project with people who deliver films on time and on budget, who get distribution for their projects. In addition, it doesn't hurt to have a movie star attached, and it doesn't hurt to have a director who's made a series of very high-class, very quality films, who also has a really strong fan base.
And small-budget films can be very profitable. I think you mentioned in the press conference that Monsters Ball was more profitable than Monsters, Inc.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I'm not saying that it's still not a very risky game. The movie business is hit-driven, but it doesn't have to be Blair Witch Project or My Big Fat Greek Wedding to do very well. In fact, actually, last year, Itu Mama Tambian was actually more profitable in a return on investment basis than My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Are you a big movie fan, Barry?
Oh, yes.
Or are you really more of a big investor fan?
You know, I'm sort of an E-Trade guy. I come from a movie background. What we did at the beginning of this was we put together a team of brokers and investment bankers who really focus on that side of things. I come from the movie fan side.
Thanks very much.
It was a pleasure, Brooke. Thank you.
Barry Polterman is the president and founder of Civilian Capital.
Coming up, remembering those who died in silence and those who died trying to tell their stories.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your letters. John Solomon's piece about the role of editing on public radio sparked the greatest response to last week's show. Libby Meehan of Wall, New Jersey, said the segment really, quote, opened her ears. I hadn't realized the assumptions I make when I listen to radio programs and how much I idealize NPR and their reporters and announcers. Listening to their smooth, seamless delivery, I assumed naively that they must be above us mortals with our occasional brain and tongue freeze. It's no wonder that they've never received complaints from interviews. I'd love to sound so smooth when I speak, too.
David Bell of Taipei, Taiwan writes, "One question I have now that I've had my peak is about the mistakes on NPR that remain after editing, such as this week's Weekend Edition Saturday when host Scott Simon stuttered on the word simultaneously. My fear now that I'm more informed is that some mistakes could be purposefully left in the final take in a truly sinister attempt to trick the listener into thinking that the entire show is unedited. Ugh."
Which leads us to some misimpressions left by that piece. Just because some programs or some parts of programs are pre-recorded doesn't mean that everything is pre-recorded all the time. For instance, Scott Simon's show may have a great deal of pre-recorded material, but his intros are mostly read live, on the air. So no flub is ever intended to deceive a listener. You can rest assured that every mistake is genuine. And another point of information, our show is produced by WNYC, not by NPR, and it is entirely pre-recorded. In fact, I'm probably taking a bath right now.
So while she's luxuriating, it's an ideal time to send your comments to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern on the TRIO channel marks the debut of Journalists Killed in the Line of Duty, an independent film documenting the diverse stories of six who died trying to get the news out. The film, produced in association with the Committee to Protect Journalists, features narrations by Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, Christiane Amanpour, and NPR's Ann Garrels, famous names all, reflecting on the lives and deaths of colleagues such as Edgar Demolario, who toiled for a small Philippines paper amid great danger, anonymous to the world outside. Stephen Rosenbaum of Camera Planet directed the film, and he joins me now. Steve, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you very much.
One of the journalists in your film was murdered by a corrupt cop in league with the drug trade in the Philippines. Others were killed in apparent battlefield accidents. Another, the Wall Street Journal's Danny Pearl, in a terrorist kidnapping. And another, NBC's David Bloom, from a blood clot suffered apparently as a direct result of covering the war in Iraq in very cramped conditions. What do these very diverse tragedies have to do with one another?
Well, the way the film was conceived, you have to understand, it began in the shadow of 9/11. And as I began to look around the world and found myself more connected to stories that were international as opposed to domestic, what I was hearing from people was that democracy was seen as synonymous with journalism around the world. And you know, a story like Demolario's in the Philippines is a fabulous example. Here's this handsome young man with a beautiful young baby boy who says to his new wife, "I have to tell the truth. If I don't, who else will?" He knew he was risking his life, but he knew there was corruption in the Philippines, and he saw this emerging democracy around him as something that he wanted to support and foster. And, you know, as a journalist in America, I found myself, as I learned about his story and others, just embarrassed in a strange way. Like, why do I take for granted this thing called journalism, which all around the world people are willing to die for?
I myself got choked up at the story of Rafael Cirriello, the Italian photographer who died in Ramallah in street fighting there by rounds from an Israeli tank. Your film shows the real-time footage in Cirriello's video camera as he falls dead.
Everything was sudden. I saw Rafael falling down, and I didn't realize he was shot.
It's not graphic, per se, but it's disturbing. As a filmmaker, was that a hard decision to make, to include that footage?
No, it was an easy decision because the challenge of the film from the outset was, how do you take 46 names, 44 of which no Americans have ever heard of, and make people connect with them in a way that makes you understand that these 46 people should not have died? They were doing really important work in really difficult places around the world, and we need to worry about the fact that they continue to die. So that tape, and some other things in the film as well, which are very emotional and some of them very private, were included to find a way to say to people, these were human beings that you need to care about.
The story of the Palestine Hotel stands out dramatically in substance and in tone from the others. Two journalists were killed there by that American tank round in what has been described as the fog of war, poor communication between the U.S. command and the troops on the ground. And Christiane Amanpour sounds very bitter and, to say nothing of skeptical, of the Pentagon's treatment of this episode. Let's hear a bit of her report.
U.S. military officials first tried to say they were not aware the Palestine was full of journalists, and they also claimed that hostile fire was coming from the hotel. But news organizations with staff at the Palestine had given the Pentagon its precise coordinates before the war began, and journalists there insist that no one was firing from their hotel. The U.S. Department of Defense conducted its own internal review, but despite repeated requests, has not made the full report public.
Steve, the CPJ concluded that the Palestine Hotel incident was, at worst, probably the result of miscommunications. Now, do you and Christiane know something that we don't know?
Well, you know, a couple of people have said to me, do you think she went too far in your film? She's really strident. She calls the government on the carpet. And you know, with all due respect to our colleagues, I think the answer is the opposite. I think the real question is, why aren't there 50 voices asking to see this report? I don't claim to know anything more about what happened. I do know how the government reacted to killing journalists, which was to shrug their shoulders and say, you know, dangerous times, people die. And I don't think that's an acceptable answer.
In the category of what if a tree falls in the forest and nobody there to hear the sound, this is appearing on the Trio channel, which is in not an enormous number of American homes. Is anyone going to see the film?
It's a fair question, and I have to say Trio is a fabulous partner. We actually went looking for a network that we internally called Switzerland. What we knew was if we did it on CNN, we wouldn't get NBC's participation, we wouldn't get CBS's, and vice versa. The networks are also competitive. And so at the end of the day, Trio has 22 million homes. It will probably be seen by, you know, one would hope, a couple of million people in the U.S. Then it will make its way internationally into a couple of deals that are pending. Then it will make its way to home video and theatrical. This is a film that will be around for a very long time. And, you know, for an independent film to start out with a million viewers, a million and a half viewers, is a big leg up for this kind of topic. I think we're going to be very pleased.
Well, Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steven Rosenbaum directed Journalists Killed in the Line of Duty, which debuts Tuesday at 9 Eastern on the Trio channel.
Recently, the Toledo Blade ran a deeply disturbing series, the result of a hot tip and many months of investigation. It details the 7-month killing spree of an elite army unit called Tiger Force in South Vietnam 36 years ago. Elderly farmers, women, children, hundreds of civilians were summarily executed. After an unprecedented 4.5-year investigation into the crimes of Tiger Force back in the early 70s, the military determined there was enough evidence to convict, but no one was convicted. Information reached the highest levels of government, but the files were locked away for good under President Gerald Ford and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, as Ford urged the public to heal the wounds of Vietnam. Oddly, this explosive scoop has not grabbed headlines in the rest of the media, although the Pentagon has responded by reopening the investigation. Michael Sallow is one of the lead reporters on the story, and he joins me from Toledo. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So about a year ago, you received a tip about a file of Army records that was being held in Washington. Did you realize what kind of story you were holding in your hands right from the start?
I think we realized that this was serious stuff that we were dealing with, the killing of men, women, and children unarmed, throwing grenades down in bunkers, creating mass graves where women and children were hiding. And then you can tell from the reports that many of these charges were substantiated by the Army. What we didn't know, though, is whether this had been promulgated or printed in any way by the media from the post-war years or even during the war.
And did you do a search?
We did. We did an intensive search. We realized from even the people that were considered scholars of the war, none had ever heard of this unit called Tiger Force, nor had heard about this war crimes investigation, which had lasted 4.5 years.
Now, you spent 8 months on your investigation after you received the documents. How did you spend that time?
Once we got those, we began to make Freedom of Information Act requests of the Army. We were unsuccessful. The Army kept saying, no, these are privacy matters. We're not going to release these particular reports to you. We then asked for a Freedom of Information with the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. There, we actually had to wait several weeks because they had to redact most of the copies, and we were handed about 1,000 pages of reports. Many of the sequential numbered pages were missing, but the heart of the investigation was there. We were able to fill in a lot of the blanks as to who some of these soldiers were, and the investigation took off from there.
And you went to those soldiers, those who were still alive.
We eventually did. We went to actually 43 soldiers over the course of that period, and some broke down. Some were very honest, very painfully honest about what had happened, their remorse over either not stopping what they saw or even participating in some of the atrocities. Some, of course, were unrepentant and offered no apologies for what they did.
Here's a piece of tape that seems to be the piece that stands in for the series as a whole. If one were to reduce it to a shorthand, it would probably be this piece of tape.
Sergeant William Doyle, who was a team leader for Tiger Force. It does summarize the actions of this unit. It exemplifies in many ways the culture that had developed within this unit over that seven-month period and even prior to that time. They were a small platoon broken into small groups. They weren't a larger line company where you had a lot of witnesses. Because Sergeant Doyle said they could pretty well do what they wanted to do.
I think it's important to point out, as the soldiers did in your article, that these weren't, you know, fog of war killings spraying indiscriminately in the midst of battle. These were executions.
And they were premeditated murders. These were going into villages and saying, wait a minute, these people aren't supposed to be here. They're supposed to be in a relocation camp. And many of them would be killed. The war in 1967 in Vietnam was one of body count. That's how we measured our success. It was not a war over the winning of territory or land or hamlets or villages. It was measured by how many more of them that we can kill than they can kill of ours. And so when the soldiers would go into these villages and they would kill civilians, they would routinely count them as either VC, Viet Cong, or NV, the enemy soldiers.
Do you think that the soldiers involved would have been ready to talk to the extent that they did to you unless there had been the passage of 36 years?
Well, I think it's clear from the record to the sworn affidavits from many of the soldiers that they opened up and confessed to Army investigators even back then, which makes the story even more poignant, the fact that the Army would have known that these things happened and would not have in any way carried out military justice as promised in the wake of the infamous My Lai massacre. The soldiers were talking about this even then during that period.
How did your interviews with the soldiers here compare with the interviews you did when you went to Vietnam?
The soldiers here clearly remember specific instances that had been documented many years earlier. The Vietnamese villagers remembered many of the same instances. These are events that are still etched in the minds of people that are living there. They remembered the victims, and they still remember them to this day in various Buddhist prayers and ceremonies.
Seymour Hersh, the noted investigative reporter who uncovered My Lai many years ago, wrote about your investigation in The New Yorker, and he was interviewed in turn by Salon.com, and he was asked if he was surprised by the lack of media pickup of your story, and he said, "I'm enraged. Are you kidding?" He said that he's particularly shocked that The New York Times has not even run a wire story about it. How about you? Do you think that the story has gotten the kind of bump up, as they say in the biz, that you think it should have?
Brooke, I think the print media has certainly done its job at picking up the story both domestically and internationally. I know AP did a fairly large pickup on this. It was picked up by nearly every major daily in the country. It got particularly widespread play in the foreign press, both in Europe and in the Pacific Rim and elsewhere, and it was translated in several languages. Peter Jennings and Ted Koppel both ran pieces on the Tiger Force series. But I'm a little surprised at the other networks.
How do you account for the fact that the media coverage of your investigation has been so much greater in the foreign press than it has been in the domestic press, and that there hasn't been a big press from reporters in Washington to get on this story?
I think that our domestic press, particularly the networks, I think there is a sense that we should not be too openly critical and evoke these painful memories of Vietnam when we're already in a conflict. I know that the Bush White House has kind of accused the Washington Press Corps of just looking for the negatives and spinning on the bad stuff. And so I believe that the Washington Press Corps has other more pressing issues that they're willing to take to the president than a 36-year-old Tiger Force case, even if it is the longest series of atrocities in the Vietnam War.
Is there a role for journalists in all of this? We spoke to an Army major, Major Bateman, before the embed program was actually underway, and he said he thought the embedding of reporters with troops could prevent future My Lais. What do you think?
I totally agree with that. I think that it can, and I think that with embedded journalists, the soldiers are more conscious of their rules of engagement and also international law. I think that they are more conscious of the fact that they must be as professional as they can be. Right now, we're not in that situation in Iraq, though. I think we have a lot of soldiers over there, and they're doing maneuvers, and there are no embedded journalists. And I think that this is where we have to be a little bit on our guard. The red flag should be going up, and I think we need to keep our command on their toes so that these things don't get out of hand and you don't have a unit like a Tiger Force spinning violently out of control.
Okay. Michael Sala, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Michael Sala is the national affairs writer for the Toledo Blade in Toledo, Ohio. He is one of the authors of his paper's expose, Buried Secrets, Brutal Truths, an investigation into the war crimes committed by the elite Tiger Force unit during the Vietnam War.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Jamie York. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and Wayne Schulmeister, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.